This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on the border between New Haven and Hamden, a wall literally comes down, hopefully healing 50 years of isolation and hard feelings between a changing city and an even faster changing suburb. And our youth correspondents from Blue Mike Radio took to the streets of Hartford to bring us their take on fashion. But coming up first, for more than a month, WNPR's Lucy Nalpathanchil has been covering the story of Jane Doe, a 16-year-old transgender female who was sent to York Correctional Institution since a court approved a rare transfer of custody from DCF to DOC. This case has gotten national attention because the girl isn't being locked up for any adult crime and because it's cast a light on how the state deals with transgender youths in its care. You can join us at 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at where we live if you have thoughts on this case. Lucy joins me in the studio now. First of all, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John.
What's the latest right now?
Well, to recap, Jane Doe was born male, but she has long identified as female. And there have been differing accounts of when she entered the DCF system. The court papers I've seen, they mention at 9 years of age, she was taken from her home because of neglect, severe abuse. Now, DCF says over the years, she's had a lot of violent outbursts, fights, assaulting staff, assaulting other children in their care. So that's why they went to court to ask the judge to approve this rare transfer. And that move has really sparked, as you mentioned, criticism across the country, because we're hearing from juvenile justice reform groups, LGBT advocates that say, you know, prison is no place for this 16-year-old. She's had significant trauma, and she's not been charged of any crime. She needs treatment. And so there's been rallies in New York City, two here in Connecticut in front of DCF headquarters. And she's written two letters. One was to DCF Commissioner Joette Katz. Jane Doe has asked, can you please remove me from York Women's Prison? Commissioner Katz went and visited her, but said that she would not move her immediately. The second letter that she wrote with the help of her attorneys was to Governor Dana Malloy. And just last week, we heard from Governor Malloy after he got that letter through his spokesperson, who the governor said that they have spoken with Commissioner Katz, and the commissioner agrees that Jane Doe must be moved to another setting as quickly as possible. And the statement goes on to say, it's our hope that Jane Doe's transition to a more appropriate setting can be accomplished in a matter of days or weeks and not months. That was on Friday. And today, she's still at York. She's isolated for the most part from the general adult population. And it's really unclear when she will be moved.
Of course, some of the other backstory that our listeners might remember is Joette Katz, the commissioner of DCF, has been in our program previously talking about the need for a locked girls facility. Some might say for girls just like Jane Doe. It was very controversial when built. Now, here's a little bit of Commissioner Katz addressing this issue with you, Lucy, in a recent interview about what the next steps for Jane Doe might be.
The court order says to be evaluated, I think it was 6 months. I mean, I wouldn't wait 6 months if she got to a point where her behaviors were under control, and I could be confident that her dangerous proclivities would not be exhibited around my other girls and my staff, I would welcome her with open arms.
And you mentioned that there are two letters written by Jane Doe, one of them to Commissioner Katz, essentially asking her to come visit her in prison. Commissioner Katz did go and visit her and essentially gave her almost the same statement that she just said to you, Lucy, that when her behavior changes, things might change.
She used the term conduct control. When her conduct is under control and her behaviors have changed, Commissioner Katz would be open to moving her back to a juvenile facility. But there's a question of whether she's getting any services right now while she's at York.
There are a lot of parts to this story, so we want to bring in Sarah Egan, who's the child advocate for the state of Connecticut, who's been part of these conversations. Sarah Egan, welcome to our studio. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Now, Lucy, I know that you've been covering this story for quite some time, and you've got some questions for Sarah Egan, so I'll let you go ahead.
As I mentioned, since Governor Malloy's statement, Jane Doe is still being held at York. So as child advocate, you've known about this particular juvenile for some time, even before she was sent to Massachusetts, then sent back to Connecticut, and then we heard about the hearing in before juvenile court. We're just wondering, from your perspective, what have you been hearing? When will Jane Doe be moved from York's women's prison?
Well, thank you for that question, Lucy. As you indicated, you know, my office has been closely involved with Jane Doe, and we meet with her regularly and talk to other advocates and other state agency folks about her situation and her challenges. Sitting here today, I don't know when she's going to be moved. I know that the Department of Corrections is actively working to move her to a more palatable setting within the York compound. And I think that they have done a lot of work to make some physical plant changes there to accommodate the needs of a minor like Jane Doe. I believe that may happen today, is my understanding. So she would be remaining at York, but in a more, as I said, more palatable kind of setting there, separate and apart from the mental health unit where she now resides.
Now, before you became child advocate, you've been involved in the reforms in the juvenile justice system. You have wide experience. And when we look at Connecticut, it's been praised by advocates for a lot of the reforms that it's done in the past two decades with raise the age and removing the youth from adult prisons. So, you know, how do we get to this point where we have a 16-year-old with extensive trauma in an adult facility?
I think that's an important question, and I think it's important to put the challenges presented by Jane Doe's situation in context. Connecticut is deservedly recognized as a leader in juvenile justice reforms. I think what Jane Doe's story highlights and what she highlights, I hate to use the word case. You know, she's not a case. She's a child. And I think what her story highlights and what it's important to recognize is that there are a lot of Jane Does. I mean, maybe not with her exact constellation of narrative and story, maybe not who are transgender and in DCF care, but Jane Doe's story is not in and of itself an outlier. When I say there are a lot of Jane Does involved with the Department of Children and Families or the juvenile justice system, what I mean is there are a lot of youth not dissimilar to her who have been the victims of significant abuse, significant neglect, who are not or have not lived in families in a long time, who exhibit traumatized behavior, which is sometimes not that distinguishable from what we'd call delinquent behavior. And, you know, my experiences before being at the Office of the Child Advocate are not isolated to juvenile justice or child welfare. These are a lot of the same youth, not all the same, but a lot of the same. A lot of the youth involved in our juvenile justice system have been or are involved with the Department of Children and Families and have been or are victims of abuse or neglect. And I think where we are still challenged as a system is where a lot of states are challenged as a system, which is around programming meaningfully for kids with very complex needs. And I think, and I don't want to give you all my thoughts in the first answer, but it is essential to remember that these children, whether they are delinquent, whether they are abused or neglected, whether they are both, need to be connected to families and their community above all else. And we struggle, not just Connecticut, others struggle as well with how do we do that for kids that exhibit very complicated behavior. And I think that Jane Doe's story really highlights the need for very close, very expert attention and partnership around that challenge.
We're talking with Sarah Egan, who's the state child advocate here in Connecticut. If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org. Or you can tweet us at Where We Live. Joining me in studio is Lucy Nalpathanchil, who is the host of All Things Considered and is also a WNPR reporter who's been covering the story of Jane Doe.
You know, you mentioned children like Jane Doe need to be connected with families in communities. And, you know, one of her attorneys who's representing her in federal court seeking an injunction is Aaron Romano. And he was at a rally on Friday in front of DCF headquarters. This is what he told us.
She needs to be in a residential treatment facility, or we've received emails from numerous families interested in fostering her. It's our position that if she's in a foster family environment, a loving environment, all the issues that DCF has regarding her aggressive behavior can be addressed with appropriate wraparound services and a loving environment.
So my question is, should she go to another treatment facility? Because she's been in and out of home placements for years. Or as Aaron Romano stated, you know, there are some foster families that are interested in taking care of Jane Doe. Yeah.
I think that's a very good question. I would say that the answers are not that both the answers are not mutually exclusive. I think it is essential that a family be identified for Jane Doe, because children do not thrive and succeed in the world without being connected to a caring, stable, nurturing adult. They don't. All kids, much less kids who have a background of being abused or neglected. And Jane needs that as much as any other child needs it. And whether she steps down, as the term is, from York to kind of an acute treatment facility, that step down has to happen concurrently to efforts to connect her with an adult who will stick with her, an adult who says, Jane, I care about you. I'm here for you. I'm not going anywhere. I believe in you. You can do it. I mean, as that is just an essential component for her, and she will need that, just like all of our other youth in DCF care need that. Does that mean she won't need or benefit from a step down to acute care? I don't know the answer to that. You know, I mean, remember, I'm a lawyer, not a clinical expert. But I work with a lot of clinical experts, and I think it's essential that the team of state agency folks who I know are working very, very hard to craft a good plan for Jane, that they work with and invite and use kind of the best expertise that can be found to help create a plan that will help Jane move forward in a healthy way, both from a treatment perspective and from a permanency perspective.
That permanency is something I wanted to ask you about. You talk about the fact that there are many Jane Does in the system with these very complex fact patterns and backgrounds filled with abuse and neglect. She's 16, which is why we're having this conversation about her as a juvenile. In 2 years, and kids grow up fast, she'll be 18. So what changes for Jane Doe in those 2 years? What changes when she becomes 18? How does the state deal with her exact same situation 2 years on?
Well, a great question. I think that depends on what happens for her in the next 2 years. If everything happens the way I think a lot of folks would like it to happen, and she finds a connection with a caring adult who's willing to be a resource for her, then hopefully she makes both therapeutic progress and maintains or obtains a permanent connection with an adult that says, you know, I'm still going to be here for you. I know you're 18, but I know you're not a grown-up. I'm here for you. I'm going to help you. I'm going to nurture you. I'm going to guide you. I'm going to show you the way into adulthood. I'm going to help you find the services you're going to continue to need. If she doesn't find that and she remains in facility care until she's 18, I think she's much, much more vulnerable, as are all of our youth who have complex needs and reside in facilities at age 18. Because of whatever constellation of challenges that they have. Navigating your way into adulthood for any child at age 18 is challenging, much less for a child who has never had the things that they really need to learn how to be a healthy adult.
There are a lot of layers to Jane Doe's story. And again, this is a juvenile who identifies as transgender. So has that complicated how DCF has responded to her over the years? You know, her advocates say that if she was not transgender, she would not have been placed at York, that DCF would have had other more options out there to place her in a treatment facility that could provide her that intensive service.
I think that's, you know, it's a question that I'd really have to speculate on. I think that the department has made many efforts over the years to honor Jane's gender identity, to support her and to treat her in an appropriate way developmentally. I think that there's no getting around the fact that her transgender status complicates placement. And as we can see, even with the Department of Corrections, you know, our landscape in terms of how state systems can accommodate transgender youth is an evolving area. So does it complicate it? I think that it does. I mean, obviously, we have a Connecticut juvenile training school that serves boys with abuse neglect histories and complex delinquent behavior. And if Jane were not transgender and identified as a boy, would she be there? I mean, I'm speculating, but probably. But for safety reasons, that may not be viable. For other reasons, it may not be viable. But again, you know, her transgender status is an important factor here. But I want to highlight the ways that she is like other kids. She is a trauma victim. She is an abuse victim. She is a girl with hopes and dreams and goals, and she needs essentially all of the same things that other kids need. So I don't want to see facilities in her future. I want to see family in her future. I want to see community in her future. I know I'm not the only one. The Child Advocate doesn't stand on a pulpit separate from DCF wanting what's good for children. DCF wants what's good for her too. And I remain open to rolling up my sleeves and sitting down with any state agency folks or anyone from the governor's office to come up and generate solutions that will move Jane forward in the way that she needs to.
We're talking on the program with Sarah Egan, who's the Child Advocate for the state of Connecticut. Also joining me is Lucy Nalpathanchil, WNPR reporter and All Things Considered host. We want to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 on this topic. Maureen's in Torrington. Hi, Maureen. Go ahead.
Hi there. I have a daughter with complex trauma conditions, and the first thing I wanted to say is, from my experience, complex trauma conditions are very difficult to deal with and can be very aggressive in a home setting. One of the things that the state of Connecticut does not have, from my experience, is adequate residential or outpatient services to address complex trauma in children. Since complex trauma conditions don't just emanate from neglect and abuse, they actually emanate from a variety of situations that children under the age of 3 can experience. We're not just talking about a small number of children with these conditions, we're talking about a large number. And I think Jane Doe is just one case where it's being highlighted because she is transgender and because she's currently in an adult facility, but the fact remains that the state of Connecticut does not have adequate services, treatment options for children with complex trauma conditions. And as these children grow and go into the adult system, I think we're seeing the backlash of that.
Maureen,
Sarah Egan could speak to that.
I would love her to. And thank you very much for raising that issue. And Sarah, to Maureen's thought?
I think that's a great call. And I think it raises some very important public health issues. And I'm glad that the caller is giving an opportunity to comment on that, which is that trauma is ubiquitous in our community. And reports from the federal government on down talk to us about the percentage of our kids that experience adverse childhood experiences, that experience trauma, that experience neglect or abuse, that experience or organic challenges. And part of helping children to be successful in families, whether it's children that are involved with Department of Children and Families or whether it's other children in our community, like the caller's talking about, part of that is about having families to healthy families who can guide children. But a big part of it is the public health challenge of ensuring that we have an adequate array of strong behavioral health services for children at the scale that we need them, with the skill and expertise with which they need to be delivered. And part of this challenge that Connecticut has in programming for youth with complex needs at the deeper end is that at every single stage of that spectrum, from 0 to 3 to 16 to 18, we don't have enough of what we need. And ultimately, there are consequences for that.
I just have to ask you one last thing before I let you go, Sarah Egan. I know that you're going to be talking with our colleague Ray Hardman on Here and Now about some of the issues that came up during the legislative session, some of the other things facing you in your job as state child advocate. I want to go back to this idea that because Jane Doe is transgender, many of us think that that is the key reason for this story gaining such national attention. Perhaps for why it's been so hard to place her. And I think you made a very eloquent plea to say that indeed she's like many other kids in many other ways. It does, though, I think, speak to the idea that the state has not adequately prepared, whether at the DOC or the DCF level, for transgender young people in their midst. We don't have a good solution right now. I don't know that many other states do have a good solution right now. Many times you've said that we're doing things to accommodate her, but wouldn't it be better if we had a plan for all transgender youth, females to males, males to females, so that we knew what to do and this wouldn't play out like this again?
Great point. I think that that is correct. And you know, child welfare expertise, juvenile justice expertise is a constant moving target. Every year we know more than we did the year before. And every year we find out more about deficits in our system that we want to build on and strengthen. I think this is an area we see two here, or three, I say. The need for families that can accommodate kids with complex needs. Two, the public health challenges around servicing the needs of children with complex challenges in the community. And three, the additional challenges for children who are transgender. And these are all areas that we need to build on and strengthen. And I know that there's a willingness to do that. I know that there's a willingness at DCF and with our community partners to do that. I know that the governor's office is very committed to looking at these issues as well. And my thought is, while this is something, I think you're correct, that a lot of states, you know, are working on at the same time, you know, there are experts out there. There are people that this is what they do and this is their field, whether it's girls' juvenile justice, whether it's working with transgender youth who are public system involved. And I would bring those folks to the table. I encourage the state to bring those folks to the table to say, help us learn more. Help us get to where we need to get to in all of these areas that we've described, so we can harness all of the solutions and expertise and creativity and innovation to identify where the gaps are in our ability to meet children's needs and to fill those gaps the best that we can.
Sarah Egan is the state child advocate. Thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
I also want to thank Lucy Nalpathanchil, WNPR's reporter and All Things Considered host. You can read her reporting on the story of Jane Doe and many of the letters and other correspondence that we've been talking about at WNPR.org. Thank you so much, Lucy.
Thank you.
When we come back from our break, we'll be joined by the New Haven Independent's Paul Bass. A fence between Hamden and New Haven that was built decades ago separated two neighborhoods. This week, Connecticut's Berlin Wall is coming down. Paul gives us an update. If you're on either side of that long-running border dispute between Hamden and New Haven, we'd like to hear from you next. 860-275-7266. Email wherelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherelive. This is Where We Live.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Go!
That is the sound of progress happening on the border between Hamden and New Haven yesterday. A chain-link fence that separated the towns for about 50 years finally came down. It says a lot about how those two communities have changed. The fact that it took so long to bring down the fence maybe tells us there's still a lot of change to come. Here to tell us the story is our friend Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent. That's where we heard that little sound. And Paul, you've been covering this story for some time. Welcome back to our show.
Hi, John. Great to talk to you.
So it's fascinating to us here at Where We Live because we tell these stories a lot about the imaginary boundaries between towns, you know, the cultural differences, the historical differences. But this was a real wall between two towns. Why was it built in the first place?
Well, it was built in two stages, John. First, a small fence was built by New Haven, believe it or not. After around World War II and afterwards, New Haven built a whole bunch of public housing projects in a quarter of town where nobody ever goes. It was all just rural behind West Rock. And over time, it became this concentration, sort of the nightmare of what we look back now in design of public housing. Four sprawling, huge, dense, crowded public housing projects that became just for the poorest of the poor, generation after generation, isolated with no stores, no way out, no other connection to community. Hamden started worrying about the fence. Some people actually would move from the New Haven side once they made enough money. I was talking to some of these folks yesterday. They would make enough money to buy a home, and they would move to the other side of the fence in Hamden and start out by a modest home and start a life that way, which is sort of the pattern that public housing was supposed to promote. And they felt there was too much crime coming from New Haven. There was a lot of crime in those public housing projects in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. It became when crack hit. That's where it hit first, I remember. And they just built, Hampton started building a fence higher and higher and reinforcing it 10 to 12 feet high, 1,500 feet across. And it separated those communities so people would actually never see each other and have the worst thoughts about each other. And practically on a day-to-day basis, all of a sudden people who rely on bus service couldn't go half a block into Hampton where, because of suburban sprawl, that's where a lot of jobs were going. That's where a lot of their friends and family were. I was still talking to people on the New Haven side yesterday who go every day to see a grandmother with their kids around the fence. And sometimes it would take, John, an hour and a half to get that one block. It's a separate subject about Connecticut Transit's abhorrent bus system. It just makes no sense. Just to make connections to get back around. And in fact, in the 90s, they wouldn't even bring any buses after 8 o'clock. So that was the historical context, John. And last night I was reading an article I wrote about this fence 17 years ago and how it looked to people then. And that was the situation. Crime on one side, run down. The neighbors barricaded on the other. No one thinks it'll ever come down. There was this dreaming by a whole generation of activists and public officials on the New Haven side whose names we don't even remember anymore, not even around anymore. And they said, maybe it'll come down one day. Maybe in the 21st century. Maybe we can dream. And then all of a sudden yesterday comes this excavator, right, from this construction company, and it just rips down the fence. And obviously everyone's thinking of the Berlin Wall, that's what we call it here. All of a sudden you can just walk right across. And the whole world had changed, the way cities deal with suburbs, the way New Haven itself designs homes for people of modest means, and the way we connect communities. It was a fascinating moment, John, and a lot has changed in that interim.
And I want to talk about some of the changes in both communities. If you want to join us at 860-275-7266, I'd love to hear thoughts from Hampden and from New Haven about the experiences you had with this wall and what you think about the fact that now it has officially come down. You can always email us where we live at WNPR.org or call 860-275-7266. Let's talk about the change of the two communities. And before we get to New Haven, let's start with Hampden. Hampden is a fascinating community that we've covered a lot on our program, Paul. It's a typical inner ring suburb in many ways. It has rural areas. It has very suburban areas. It has very urban areas. The racial and ethnic mix has been changing over the years. It's got a big university in Quinnipiac. It seems like as much as New Haven has changed over the course of the last couple of decades, Hampden's changed even more.
That's a great point, John. A number of factors are at play there. And we've seen it with other inner ring suburbs as well. Some of the challenges of a city move out to suburbs that are right next door, and they're not as well equipped to deal with them. So one thing people never talk about is the first president, George Bush, wanted to dilute the Democratic vote, so he made Section 8 vouchers portable. Section 8 vouchers come from the government, that instead of living in a public housing project, you could take that voucher and go to a landlord who will take the money and usually rip off the government and get a big rent and put you anywhere. So all of a sudden, people in public housing started moving to West Haven, to Hampden. But it wasn't just that. People who had moved up in the world a little bit were moving up a step, buying the homes like in this very area of Hampden we're talking about, and southern Hampden became very diverse. And the whole town became more diverse, but especially southern Hampden. It became a very solid, working-to-middle-class neighborhood, very much mixed of black and white, which you see on the other side of this fence. And that was definitely one of the changes. And then I don't know if you want to talk yet about the changes on the New Haven side of the fence.
I think we should. And one of the things that you highlight, if you go to the New Haven Independent website, you see pictures of some of the new style housing in the area. You can visibly see some of the changes in New Haven, not just in that neighborhood, but in many others. Talk about what's changed in New Haven over this time.
The irony, John, is that now the really fancy, beautiful houses are on the New Haven side of the fence. And that's funny. I mean, one of the aldermen from West Rock, who'd always lived on this other side, said yesterday, we're going to charge Hampden to come over here because it's so nice here. It's more complicated than that. But New Haven, like cities throughout the country, rethought public housing over the last 20 years. When we say the word public housing project, and John, you get in trouble if you use that word anymore. I'd say project because it has an image in your mind.
Sure.
In the second half of the 20th century, you had a very specific image, crowded, dense, either high-rises or these completely poorly built, run-down brick or cement block Soviet-style row apartments, and that you see just hardscrabble lawns and everything, people moving in and out, open air drug dealing. And what New Haven decided to do was do something called the HOPE 6 program, which it's a federal program to rebuild housing, where you make them these mixed-income communities. You have people who own homes as well as people who don't. You have an income mix. You intensely screen, and you make them nice places to live. You actually spend a little more, and that's been controversial in New Haven. People don't like the fact that they're building better housing. They put these really lovely houses, you know, wood frame, two or three story, gaps between them, a lot of landscaping, nice street grids, and it's these idyllic suburban style neighborhoods, almost McMansions, but not quite. And they did that in that area. They've been gradually tearing down all four public housing developments in New Haven on that area in West Rock. And they match others we've done across town, places called Quiddipiac Terrace, Elm Haven, which has a new name, which some of the most dangerous and rundown parts of town are now some of the most lovely looking, and at least for now, we'll see that over time, very stably run communities. I talked to the head of the Housing Authority, Karen DeBruce-Walton, about this. They believe part of the reason is that they've outsourced management to private companies for those communities. That's another discussion for another show. But in any case, the whole idea is you connect people more rather than isolate them. The mayor, Tony Hart, who made this fence come down, finally talked about this yesterday. She said, when we're rebuilding a city and when we're rebuilding a region, we need to connect people. We need people to walk half a block and be connected to Hamden, New Haven, because they're not separate communities. The families, the jobs, the recreation, everything takes place across these invisible borders, which were not invisible at this one spot. Mm. And within the city, public housing can't be segregated from the rest of the city. And within public housing, you can't be segregated by class. So that is what's changed on both sides of that fence.
We're talking with Paul Bass, who's the editor of the New Haven Independent. If you want to read more about this fascinating story about not just an imaginary, but a real boundary coming down between Hamden and New Haven, you can go to the New Haven Independent website and you can see pictures as well. We'd like to hear from you at 860-275-7266 and also getting your emails. We got a call from Joan earlier who said to us, and she's from Hamden, she said her mayor allowed New Haven to railroad residents. He's not working in the best interests of Hamden, but in the best interest of himself. That's Joan's thought. Any thought about the personalities at play here? Scott Jackson?
Yes, Jackson is the mayor of Hamden, the first African-American mayor. That caller is completely off base. The last thing Scott Jackson ever wanted was for that fence to come down because of the headaches he gets. He wasn't ideologically opposed to it. He tried to work with New Haven on bringing the communities together. They tried to have barbecues, movie nights, but no one from the Hamden side came. Scott Jackson, if he wants higher office, this kills him because his neighborhood's going to blame him for the fence coming down. The real reason the fence came down was because the federal government was about to sue Hamden for discrimination, and a land survey was done, and people didn't realize for 50 years that the fence is actually on land owned by the New Haven Housing Authority. It's technically in Hamden, but the Housing Authority owns the land. So it turns out that they could just take down the fence. They discovered that last fall. Mayor John DeStefano wasn't ready to do that. A new mayor, Tony Hart, came in and said, look, we tried working with Hamden. This isn't going to happen. We just have to take it down. It's been too long. It's not even safe. We have big storms now. You have an elderly housing development there. They're trapped there in any kind of flooding. This is dangerous. It's sick. It's wrong. It's the 21st century. It's just coming down. We could take it down. We could come it down. So Scott Jackson, the mayor of Hamden, gets pulled into the U.S. Attorney's Office with a mediator last week. And he gets read the Riot Act. And he had his own lawyer look at it and said, yeah, it is their fence. They could take it down. So I can fight it to stand up so that callers like Joan can feel I'm fighting for them in a fake fight that looks politically convenient so that I can run for higher office one day and look like I threw red meat at people who didn't want to accept that the world changed. Or I could see that I'm about to be sued by the federal government, and the federal government threatens Scott Jackson. They said, we're going to take away your other federal housing money, which he needs, which has already been cut. We're talking $300,000 he needs. And they said, look, if you go ahead and do some kind of fake fight that you know you can't win anyway, that you have no legal basis, we're going to take away your other money. You're going to lose. You have no legal standing. So in fact, Scott Jackson reluctantly took a responsible position based on facts, based on the interests of his town, and he's very upset about it. He wishes they still had John DeStefano there so that they can continue talking about it for another 20 years. And then he can move on to higher office and people like Joan would vote for him.
Well, we got an email from the other side of the fence. Alicia emails, I'm a New Haven resident, thrilled that Mayor Harp had the leadership and courage to tear down this fence and to prioritize this relatively early in her term. I think it speaks volumes, she writes, about her views. I can't help but wonder, she continues, how did our last administration of 20 years not know that this was on New Haven property? Were they sitting on this information for political reasons?
Well, they weren't sitting on it for a long time. They discovered it in the fall. And there wasn't a whole lot, when I wrote about 17 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of movement to tear it down. People in West Rock wanted to tear down, the public housing people, they didn't have a whole lot of clout. And there wasn't all this investment in that community. A lot has changed since then. And now there's sort of more crime on the Hamden side. They, you know, you listen to the neighbors who are upset, they actually say, we already had a murder near here. We already had all this stuff on my lawn and the drugs. That didn't come from the other side of the fence. That came from their side. And so something changed. So they sat on it since the fall. And I think that you didn't have to act the first day. I think this person writing in is right that Mayor Harp moved faster than her predecessors. She just made this decision that we can do it. We tried enough. The time has come. Time to act.
Well, let's get to a phone call here. Steve's calling from Walcott. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am one of those people who started on one side of the fence and ultimately moved to the other. I have to be honest, I don't ever remember a day that that fence was not there. It was there when I was growing up, when my family finally went and bought a house across the fence in Hamden. The fence was still there, and I'm glad to see it's coming down. But as I said, I don't ever remember a time when the fence wasn't there.
Steve, can I ask you, was the fence mostly a psychological barrier, or was it a real physical barrier in the life that you remember there?
I think it was both. Part of the reason my parents moved from one side of the from the housing project on the New Haven side to the small little four room cape on the Hamden side was to move out of the city and away from bad influences, as how they put it. We were three small growing kids and starting school, and they just didn't want us in the New Haven environment. And they felt that it was a significant difference on the other side of the fence.
Steve, thank you very much. I really appreciate your phone call.
Thanks so much.
That made me think of one more irony in this, John, which I love all the subtle ironies below the surface. One of those four housing developments is for elderly, called the Ribicoff Cottages. They're about to be built now. They're in their own corner of it. Part of the fence goes there. The fence is going to come down there, too. Some people there actually did not want the fence to come down because the elderly publicly housing tenants had memories of crime from the other developments, and they actually felt that that fence was keeping them safer. So just as on the Hamden side, you had people who did want the fence to come down, not a majority, but I met someone just like Steve yesterday. I met two people, William Tucker and Felicia Jones. Just like Steve, they had grown up at Brookside. 20 years ago, they got the money to buy a new house. They moved across the side, and they said it should come down. It's time, but it was there for a reason. And people are interesting. You know, you can make generalizations about the general sentiment. The cheering you played did take place on the New Haven side. They weren't cheering on the Hamden side. But there were people on the Hamden side who said it was time and it was right, and there were even some elderly people on New Haven side who weren't as ready.
I want to get to Christine in New Milford. And Christine, I'm sorry, you just have 30 seconds left with Paul Bass. Go ahead.
My name is Justine. Paul, just the more prominent example that this makes us think of is not the Berlin Wall, but the wall in the West Bank that the Israelis divide Palestinians from Israeli settlers and particularly Palestinians from their land. And so the only difference, like in New Haven, is that people are different, you know, ethnic backgrounds. Palestinians are not Jewish. And so it's a great example if the wall came down in the West Bank, where peace might begin to happen.
Justine, thank you very much for the phone call. Paul, I think she's led us into another entire conversation that I'll have to have you back at some other time for.
Okay.
Hey, Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent. You can read all about this story and much more at their website. Thanks again, Paul. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
Coming up next, we'll hear from some talented Hartford high schoolers from the podcast Blue Mic Radio. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We will look back at the 2014 legislative session and a look at the massive implementer bill passed on the very last night. We've still got Colin McEnroe and a team of interns locked in a room reading every page. We'll also be previewing this weekend's state party conventions. Those will move the campaign season into full swing. You can join us for those stories and much more coming up on The Wheelhouse here on Where We Live. Now, a few weeks ago, during a panel discussion with state lawmakers, we featured a group of high school correspondents from Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy. They did an interview about legislation surrounding high school dropouts. These seniors are working with WNPR's Katie Talarski on a podcast called Blue Mic Radio. You can listen at bluemicradio.tumblr.com. They'll be joining us periodically over the next few months, and today they're here to talk about something that I almost never talk about, fashion.
I'm Nardia Gale.
And I'm David Bowie. Today we're talking about fashion and individuality.
Yeah, David and I have very different styles when it comes to fashion. For example, I love to color my hair in bright colors.
Yeah, I love the emo punk look.
We brought together Blue Mic Radio's Grady Montalvo and Karan Johnson to explore our very unique styles.
Let's riff.
Describe your personal style.
My personal style is more of the emo look, because the emo look is pretty cool. I like having my hair straightened and flipped halfway over my face, and the skinny jeans and the tight shirts, and also I have my collar, so it's pretty awesome.
I really don't know how to define my style. Normally I just wear skinny jeans or pants. I like dresses, I really do. Although I don't like skirts, I don't know why. But I really can't define my style, because I don't know how you call that.
My style is more calm and secluded. I can't really explain. Really, I just dress normal, like the average person. I wear pretty much anything. It doesn't matter to me.
Normal.
Is there anything wrong with being normal?
Normal is boring. I think normal is like white rice.
What?
White rice is boring.
You still eat it?
Well, no, I don't. I usually add something in there to make the white rice taste like something.
My style...
No offense, Karan.
My style is I love colorful hair. I love changing my hair color, whether it's from red to blue to purple or blonde and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. We all wear glasses here. I think glasses do kind of stylize your outfit, depending on the color. My glasses now are black, and they're not like these huge lenses. I have the really small one, smart looking.
You mean the hipster lenses?
No offense to anyone that has huge.
I have hipster lenses.
What makes glasses cool, though?
What makes glasses?
Glasses are cool.
Glasses are cool.
Yeah. But cool. Especially
like,
those glasses that,
like
when
face clothes.
When you hit the sun, they turn like black.
Yes.
Mine's like that.
Daniel
yeah,
has those.
I love those glasses. Yeah.
They're pretty cool.
As you know, we all live in Hartford, Connecticut. When it comes to style, Hartford used to have lots with G. Fox and Stage Allen. People would drive for miles to shop in department stores downtown. But what about now? I'm not so sure.
Wait a minute, Nardia. I have style, and I live here. But you're right. There isn't a lot of retail left in the city, except Pratt Street, Hartford's little fashion mecca. Stackpole Moore and Tryon has been in town for 45 years. Hartford Denim Company makes their own jeans. What?!
We interviewed some of Hartford's fashionistas earlier this month. They'll be part of an event on May 17th, Hartford High Style, a fashion show and dance party.
Stuart Miller knows about glasses. He owns Opticians Unlimited.
Who influenced you in your style?
Probably my parents. Both my parents were actually in the clothing industry growing up, so I was always around different fabrics and different kinds of stuff.
How can you help people express themselves with glasses?
Sometimes it depends what you do for a living and how you want to project yourself. So if you were a lawyer, you might want a horn-rimmed glass to say, hey, I'm really smart and I have this sort of look about myself. If you were a fashion designer, if you were a graphic artist, you'd probably want glasses with lots of color. Once two people come in together and they shake hands and they're having a conversation, from here down, that's sort of gone. From here up is what they're going to have that conversation. And so if you have crooked glasses, or your glasses are, the nose pads are all green, you don't look professional. You don't look like you know what you're doing. We like to think that glasses are as much a part of who you are as any of the other accessories you're wearing on your body.
we talked to Hartford resident Joe Jones, who was wearing awesome red glasses.
How has style changed since you were a teenager?
Well, when I was a teenager, you were conservative, as they would say. You wore button-down shirts, cardigans, and then there was other styles where you would wear shoes like what they call banisters. They were real slick shoes, and Edwin Claps. And you'd buy those from stores like Packet Boot Shop on Silent Street, and also there was a store called Horse Falls. It was very stylish stores. You had Crips, Warren Bailey, Bass Socks, Stackpoles, of course. And also you could shop at G. Fox & Company, Sage Allen's. You had another little store around the corner over there, Bond's Clothing Store, Saul's. There was another one down by the park, Wood & Wood. That was real in a real nice exclusive place to shop. There was a number of places that you could really be out there, really be separate in your own style.
And if you don't mind me asking, where did you shop?
Everywhere.
Everywhere?
Yes. I'm always shopping in my head. If I'm traveling, I'm shopping. It doesn't have to be a particular store. As long as it's hip and I feel it, you know, you have to feel it. And don't worry about what people are going to think or they're going to say. You just do your own thing. And this is it. This is how you create style. Because someone might be watching.
All right, well, thank you for your time. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Julie Ramirez is a fashion consultant at Stackpole Moore and Tryon.
Hartford has classic style as well as very modern, I would say, because, I mean, obviously, it's what we offer and what we present to people, and we encourage people to express themselves, certainly through style.
How does what you wear define who you are?
It's just the way you present yourself, and no matter what we say, the first thing somebody notices about you is certainly the way you look and the way you carry yourself.
How has your style changed since when you were a teenager?
Gosh, for the better, I hope. Well, yeah, I grew up in the 80s, so what can I tell you? I think everybody who grew up in the 80s can certainly relate to the fact that it was very colorful. It was really kind of anything goes. It was a mixture of punk. It was a mixture of rock. It was a fun time to grow up, an experiment.
And Keith Clater owns Time Frozen Photography.
Hartford has style because it's really a city of just a huge blend of people. You know, just a lot of different dynamics, a lot of different personalities, and it's one of those places where, you know, there's a lot of, it's classic, but people express themselves through fashion and through, you know, the way that they dress.
How do you contribute to style in Hartford?
I contribute by capturing the style in Hartford, so I'm not necessarily on the front side of the fashion industry, but I'm on the back side of it. And, you know, we see the beauty in the people of this city, and we capture it.
What do you think about my style? Or yep. My collar, I should say.
I dig the collar, actually. I dig the collar. And again, that kind of goes towards what I was talking about. Everybody in the city has their own individual style, and even in something where people dress traditionally, they put their own little twist on it. And that's what you see a lot of in this city, is people putting their own stamp on classic style.
You can find out more about the May 17th Hartford Fashion Event at hartfordhasstyle.com. You can see photos from our Pratt Street photo shoot at bluemicradio.tumblr.com.
But for now, I have to go brush my hair. So we'll catch you next time.
You're listening to Blue Mic Radio.
We are Grady Montalvo,
Nardia Gale,
Karan Johnson,
and David Bowie.
Blue Mic Radio is a project of Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy Magnet School, produced with the assistance of WNPR's executive producer, Katie Talarski. Thanks also to Paul Pfeffer and Jim Moffat. You can find out more and listen to their podcasts at bluemicradio.tumblr.com. That's Blue M-I-C Radio. Where we live, we'll occasionally be airing excerpts of their work over the next few months. Our producers are Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown, along with Katie Talarski. Thanks so much for joining us on today's Where We Live.